Hi, this is Paul. I don't have a lot of time today, but I want to do a little bit of commentary on the recent Religious Wars of the Pandemic Endgame by Rebel Wisdom. I saw this pop up. I noted the religious thing. Actually, David sent me a note and said, you might be interested in this video, and he usually doesn't send me personal notes about videos that they release. So when he did that, I thought, oh, David has followed the channel and followed the conversation, so he knows what I'm interested in. He'll sometimes comment, yeah, it was a 20-minute video, and you did a 2-hour commentary on it, so what's up with that? And he doesn't say it that way. He's far more generous, but I did, in fact, find this to be a very interesting video, and I probably am not going to have the time to go into it as detailed as I'd like, but I thought it was interesting, especially because they're framing it in terms of religion. And that's interesting, of course, because I'm a minister, so I'm interested in religion. And one of the things that swirls around us all the time is the question of the definition of religion, because the word religion is a tremendously difficult thing to define. And when we have a global event like this pandemic, and we have the kind of polarization and disagreements like we've had all around the world, but in the United States around this pandemic, it's a moment when we should probably be paying attention and learning, because there's stuff to learn about ourselves. So let's jump in.
So this is a piece we've been working on for a while about COVID and the pandemic, largely fueled by a sense of like the narratives really shifting. Things are moving and things are also getting weirder. Things are definitely getting weirder.
Now if we pay attention to language, and he says the narratives are shifting, and of course he did that conversation with BJ Campbell, the egregores, and we've sort of been turning up the heat on trying to feed our imagination with respect to the best way to conceptualize things that we're talking about in terms of the narrative, in terms of what we mean by this word idea. We talked about that a little bit in the Friday question and answer, talking about egregores, principalities and powers. Things are moving through our culture, and part of the poverty of modernism is that we don't adequately have language for it. The kinds of language that ancients would have readily imagined, because, again, they had a very different conceptualization of this.
Partly it was sparked by the recent Joe Rogan interviews with Robert Malone and Peter McCullough, which felt like a kind of tipping point for what you might call the antithesis position. And there's so many different angles to it. There's so many different angles to the challenge of finding sense making with something as vast as the pandemic. And also taps into all of the different topics we've talked about on the channel before.
Now even when we get into this question of what do we mean by sense making, and this is, again, why I think religion is a valid word to use in this context, because it's not like we're sort of brains on a stick, that we're just out there deciding to come to propositions about things. We all navigate in a very nuanced way many, many questions that we sense are beyond us, that we can't know. If I walk into a room, is the COVID there? And right away say, well, that's not really exactly the way to think about it, but it is kind of the way we think about it. And right away, when the pandemic started, we noticed that just by our words, there was sort of a new imaginary presence that was biological, because it's a pandemic and people were getting sick, and you can test COVID in a laboratory, and now on test kits that are readily available, mailed out by the U.S. government and by your insurance company, et cetera, et cetera. But how exactly does this filter through everything that we are and do?
Well, there's a free speech angle to it. There's the culture war angle, there's the fragmentation, there's the different levels of how we're emotionally hooked by certain narratives. And the one that really came through strongly while we were pulling this together was the sense of like the religious dimension, that almost the theological dimension underneath it, that's fueling so much of the passion and the certainty and the warfare, and also these kind of religious manifestations of kind of scapegoating and clean and unclean, particularly regarding like the vaccine situation. And then
okay, we should slow that down, because we should figure out, well, exactly what sense of religious is he talking about here?
Hooked by certain narratives. And the one that really came through strongly while we were pulling this together was the sense of like the religious dimension, that almost the theological dimension underneath it.
Okay, so what do we mean by that? So Scott Adams would talk quite a bit about two movies. And in this sense, we're sort of seeing religion as an interpretive filter. It's an interpretive filter by which we're all looking at the world through a particular perspective. Now, we might imagine, let's see if I pull it back a little bit. So basically, you've got a degree in which you've got two people looking at the world through two different religious filters. Now, even this drawing looks very modern and materialistic, because it sort of imagines that what we might call base reality is sort of this material thing that we are looking at. And of course, we're interpreting it through our own religious filters. And that's true. And part of the transformation that's been going on is we recognize that this isn't just a matter of perspective, but in terms of the first personal world, we're also constructing the world that we live at, that we live through. There are, of course, all of these value hierarchies that are part of what makes up a religion. And in fact, there are many, many components which intersect in terms of religion. And so we're going, and when you have a situation like this, you're going to get a high degree of polarization where people seem to be living in different worlds, even though in fact they are both dealing with a world that is constructed of all of these things.
Much of the passion and the certainty and the warfare, and also these kind of religious manifestations of kind of scapegoating and clean and unclean, particularly regarding like the vaccine situation. And then on the other side, these kind of all-encompassing conspiracy narratives as another kind of religious phenomenon. And yeah, this sense that that's the frame that we've used probably more than any other, in this sense that we're in post-secular times. And if we don't recognize that, then we're going to be potentially kind of overtaken by narratives without realizing, like, they're religious narratives that are showing up through politics or showing up through other means. And the other,
and when he says we're in post-secular times, in some ways what he's saying is that what secularity tried to do was say, well, we're going to take the entire frame here, but we're going to sort of label parts of it and say, well, parts of this are private and parts of this are public, and we're sort of going to divvy up the world. But now recognizing the fact that, well, we are seeing the world in this way, the secular really isn't working. You almost had the idea, and I wanted to talk. Oh, I hate it when I do that. You very much get the sense that things are getting very meta in this way. That, well, it's post-secular because, of course, your view of the world through this also has a filter, and we'll call that religion, and you're viewing this religion and that religion, and you're viewing this, but you're understanding it as first personal rather than third personal, which is down from above.
The major question that I've been wrestling with, which is what is responsible heterodoxy, where you're challenging the kind of holes in the mainstream narrative, and where does it go off the road and into the ditch on the other side? So I spent weeks pulling this together, speaking to lots of different people, including John Vervaeke, Mary Harrington, Paul Kingsnorth, and I played clips from them, and also talk about different kind of articles, mental models, different frameworks, and all of those that I reference, I'm going to put in the show notes below.
Yeah, it's interesting. You use the phrase post-secular, and I thought, but you also use the phrase religious, and I kind of thought, yeah, post-secular is, it's interesting, it's kind of a euphemism, because I think part of what's going on right now is that we are living through the birth of many new religions. And I think there's a discomfort in culture, and there's perhaps a discomfort in when we're trying to make sense of things with thinking of things as a religious phenomena. But I think it is.
Now, why are we coming into the birth of new religions? We've talked about that. We've talked about that quite a bit. Once you have narratives will generate communities, especially in an internet age where we sort of can find each other easily. And once you have those communities, there are going to be practices and habits and reinforcements and value hierarchies and disciplines that create structure to those communities, and even institutions that come out of those communities. And whether or not these communities are tied to some of the large overarching religions that are out there, or they become like these micro things that Tara Isabella Burton was talking about in Strange Rites, you're going to have all of these new religions.
It is one of the key frames to look at it through, because it doesn't start to make everything make sense. That's one of the traps we fall into, in sense making, like, God, that's what it is. It's an aspect of it, but I think it's a very useful aspect of it. We've talked about it a lot on the channel, that we are living in religious times. I've called it the age of breach, because I think one of the things we're seeing, and I think we're seeing it with the pandemic situation as well, is sort of proto-religions forming online in this kind of imaginal space of our imaginations. It's all words, it's all videos, it's all kind of images. And the final thing I want to say about that is that it's not a bad thing. Like, the return of a kind of the unconscious, the irrational, and the, for want of a better term, religious, is something that it's a deeply human thing. This is the first time in history we haven't had it, pretty much arguably since the birth of what we would call modern kind of Homo sapiens, or at least not had it as a deeply institutionalized kind of aspect of culture. And I think we have to roll with it and take it on its own terms rather than trying to move away from it, because, we need it to make sense of what's going on. Yeah.
At some point, you have to ask, what are the things that developed the secular? And if, in fact, the secular was sort of a monofocal perspective on the world, well, maybe not only a visual perspective, but an audio perspective. This from The Rest Is History, the birth of the Modern World, from their thesis about 1922, where a bunch of these things came together.
You know what also the Daily Mail also created, which is a huge part of the culture of 1922, and in some ways you could argue the year's most lasting and important legacy? Radio.
Right. So tell us about radio, Dominic.
So, you know, people have been experimenting with radio broadcasts and whatnot for years. The key person in Britain is a man called Marconi, who set up the Marconi Company, who's obviously an Italian immigrant. And in 1920, he gets sponsorship from the Daily Mail to do the first live entertainment broadcast. Which is done by Dame Nellie Melba. She sings the song, and the Marconi Company broadcast it. And this is one of their, the Daily Mail are great, hugely into stunts at the beginning of the 20s. So at one point, Lord Northcliffe invents a new hat, for example. And they're always trying all these different wheezes.
Why are they not doing that now?
I think they probably are. I mean, I haven't invented a new hat for them, but, give it time.
Get on with it.
The Marconi Company, they're the real pioneers in Britain of radio. So it's in early 1922, I think it's February, actually, 14th of February, that you have the first regular broadcasts, which are from a hut, which I've been to, Tom, actually, because I did a documentary about this for the BBC, because this is where the BBC comes from. There's a hut in a place called Rittle, which is outside the Marconi factory in Chelmsford in Essex, and a man called Peter Eckersley would broadcast on Tuesday evenings for half an hour. And they were the first regular radio broadcast.
Now this is going to feed into, obviously, a lot of the narratives that David and Ali have been developing about heterodox narratives versus, and you know, even adopting, which is language that David has been using for quite a while. Heterodox is, of course, a loan word from my world, because heterodox is in contrast to orthodox, and I thought that Peter Lindbergh and his thesis and antithesis on the pandemic is also a good framing. But of course, what we've seen is the way that this stuff has proliferated. You've certainly had polarizations where you have competing poles, but you've got all of this within. Now, part of what happens with these successive technologies as they move into as they really create the modern era, you of course have the printing press at about the same time that you get the Protestant Reformation. So you've got all of these forces. And now in the 20th century, you're going to have a compiling, a speeding up of technologies and how that both creates the secular, but also then will, especially with the internet, pull it apart. But you've also got the other layers underneath manifesting themselves in different ways. And they're going to go into the different ways that, let's say, the in the UK, the way they approached radio and the way it rolled out in the United States.
In Britain or in the world?
In Britain. Now, what's happened in America is that you have had this explosion of radio at exactly the same time, but in America it's completely unregulated. So you have kind of maybe 100 radio stations by the spring, and then in the summer you have hundreds of radio stations in America.
Right. So it's like kind of internet startups suddenly.
It's exactly.
And again, now this is what technology does in many ways, because whereas before, let's say, a certain way of being or a way of talking was in an individual and you actually needed access to that individual or fellowship with that individual. With print, of course, the words can get put onto paper and into language and can go out into the world. Now, with the technology, you're still going to have individuals and they're going to fight for, you know, eventually you're going to have things like intellectual property right and you're going to have celebrity and you're going to have all of these things. But the mechanics of radio means that you can have many, many stations and, well, then suddenly all of the filters are going to get upped.
Exactly that. So lots of people have asked questions about, you know, what is the most important invention or discovery that is associated with the sort of modernity of the 20s. So Kevin Douglas asks about broadcasting. Chris Salmon says, which is the most important invention? And I would say the answer is radio, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think what's so interesting about it is in America, it is advertising funded. And there's this explosion of radio stations throughout the summer of 22. There's this sort of sense of chaos and free for all. And in Britain, the people observe this and they say, oh, my God, we can't have anything like this. This mm-hmm. is an absolute sort of, this would be the worst possible thing. And they actually say, you know, it's an anarchy, it's chaos. And of course, that we were talking last time about that the absolute ubiquitous fear of anarchy and of Bolshevism and all this kind of thing and the thirst for order at the beginning of the 20s. And I sort of wonder whether that's in people's, you know, they have this hatred of disorder and of uncertainty, unsurprisingly after what they've been through. And so the Marconi Company and five of the other big companies get together and they want to set up a monopoly licensed by the government, which will be called the British Broadcasting Company. And that's what basically happens.
And that's what happens.
So they get together and by October they have formed what becomes basically the BBC. And the BBC starts its first regular radio broadcasts on the 14th of November 1922. And to listen to them, you need a radio set, which are, I mean, they're not cheap, and you have to pay a 10 shilling license fee. And the license fee...
So right from the beginning, the license fee is there.
The license fee is there right from the beginning. What isn't there right from the beginning is complaining about the license fee, which comes in later.
Right.
But you know who despises the BBC, Tom? Our old friend from the previous episode, Virginia Woolf.
Does she?
She does not believe in... she's horrified by the idea of bringing high culture to the masses. Because she said, look, they won't understand it. It'll destroy her culture. It's
all
right.
So you could see how all of these things are developing, right?
Woolf complains at one point that the BBC's first director of talks, who is this pioneering, extraordinary woman called Hilda Matheson. Wolf doesn't like her. She says there are two things wrong with her. One, she's got a wooden face.
Right.
And the other...
Virginia Woolf's face, famously.
Yeah, of course. Virginia Woolf of all people. And then Virginia Woolf says the other thing she doesn't like her is that she lives in South Kensington.
She the vulgarity.
She regards as middle class, drab and dreary,
Yeah.
So
she's a cracker.
Yeah, lovely person. So from a British point of view, I would say that's absolutely the most important thing about 22 is that.
Did you read about the first drama broadcast on BBC?
No, go on. Give me.
Went out on Christmas Eve.
Yeah,
and it was called "The Truth About Father Christmas."
Oh my God. So what a thing to put out on Christmas Eve.
I know everyone's put away their Christmas decorations, but a little festive, last final festive touch there. That was the first ever BBC drama.
Does it tell the real, what's it say?
I don't know what it's about. I'm guessing it's the truth about Father Christmas, don't worry.
That's probably lost now.
Maybe it's on BBC Sounds with their unfair monopoly.
I like your framing about just seeing it as a religious phenomenon shouldn't be that kind of aha moment that, now we suddenly understand it, because that's just being caught in exactly the same dynamics that will come in.
Right, because once you label it as religious, okay, well, what does that tell you? Well, what does it tell us? It's a very good question. I think it suggests how deep this goes, and at least for people like myself, it suggests that, this isn't something apart from everything else I do during my day.
I'm into later. John Bavakey talks about this a lot. Kind of insight porn is one way of looking at it. Addiction to insight is another one. We're all groping in the dark. And I think starting from that, we're groping in the dark, trying to make sense of things just as much as anyone else. What I have done in this is to talk to as many people as I can who understand this, and I'll play a few short clips from them in a second, and then we'll have more from them later in the piece. Again, everything that we're referencing, I'll put down in the show notes below so you can follow up. Rebel Wisdom is really about giving people the tools to make sense better, and some of those are practices, some of those are mental models, some of those are links to articles and things that we found that we find really useful. So we'll put all the resources in the show notes.
Now, it's even the framing of that, we're here to give the tools. It's not terribly post-secular, because in a sense that still engages in sort of the division between, well, these are the tools and these are the outcomes. And it's a very legitimate distinction, but, you know, David's background is, of course, in secular journalism, which is supposed to present the objective, the third personal. And so, well, we're just giving you tools. To be post-secular, well, how post-secular can you be if you're just giving tools?
And the first framework that I think is really useful is Peter Lindbergh's concept of the COVID thesis and the COVID antithesis, which is roughly speaking, the thesis is the mainstream media perspective. It's pro-lockdown and masks, universal vaccination, saying that alternatives like ivermectin lack evidence and that vaccine mandates are needed. The antithesis is the counterpoint and alternative, which is generally anti-lockdown, anti-mask, saying that vaccines have been oversold or are actually dangerous, that early treatments like ivermectin have been suppressed, and most importantly, they're concerned that in things like vaccine passports, we're seeing the first step towards something like a social credit system and towards increasingly draconian control measures.
Okay, now it's helpful. Now, of course, they're out of the UK. The UK clearly keeps a very close eye on the United States and our media wars and our culture. But what's been interesting is just how overtly religious, using the word religious in a way that Sam Harris would embrace, how overtly religious this whole thing has become. Many, many people have showed that, and they've shown this as basically justification for ammunition and for the fight of their culture war, of course.
So yeah, using this thesis antithesis divide, you can start to see, okay, how is the religious dimension starting to show up in the thesis side? And Mary Harrington had this really great piece.
And that's incredibly important because in the thesis side, because in the secular frame, the thesis side wants to say, this isn't about anything in terms of religion. So right there, even the definition of religion is pegged by the side.
A couple of days ago in Unheard, called Vaccine Purity Has Infected the West, and I caught up with her.
It came to me to seem as though vaccination has become a vehicle for talking about purity and sanctity. And in fact, a lot of COVID rituals, COVID pandemic control measures have become a sort of vector for the re-entry into a much a sort of mainstream progressive left discourse of something much older, which is to say a sort of purity discourse, which I would previously have associated much more with religion.
Now, again, what does she mean by that, a purity discourse? Well, basically, you're saying that there are categories that around which religions reliably express. And so very quickly, we're into Jordan Peterson, Jonathan Haidt, Haidt categories, because these are things that overall... anthropologists have noted that your culture is going to have these aspects. And that then pushes, again, the definition of religion away from ideas about the supernatural, holy books, a bunch of these types of framing, and into the framing that religion is in many ways sort of the base category for first personal viewing of the world.
So this is not to say, just to be absolutely crystal clear, this is not to say that vaccination has become religious exactly, but it's to say it's become a delivery mechanism for something with religious character.
Well, you put your faith in Pfizer. Okay. So again, there is a religious valence because part of religion is about trust. And those of you who saw my Rough Draft of Sunday this week, now I'm going to tell you the tricks. If you look at carefully, because my black and yellow slides often have the text on them, and usually if I take the text from a particular translation of the Bible that's out there in the marketplace, it will be shown like the NIV. Sometimes you'll notice the text and there's no NIV or NRSV or ESV or KJV or any of those things, well, it's because I've doctored it. Well, and then sometimes when I point that out, people get upset. Well, how dare you change the Bible? I say, well, wait a minute. The NIV is the creation of a group of scholars. And I've, based on my own analysis, my own study, my own sermonic decisions, I've decided to use some different words that are very legitimate translations of these words, well within the lexical range. I'm not trying to deceive anyone here. And again, in the Sunday sermon, I swapped out believe, which tends to make everything propositional, very much puts it in the modern frame, into trust, which brings things into the other three Vervaeke P's, the perspectival, the procedural, the participatory. That's where trust is. Believe sort of swoops us up there into the propositional. The perspectival, the participatory, the procedural, that's very much first personal.
So that's just a short clip. I'll play a bit more from the interview later in the piece. And to be honest, I feel like the antithesis position reached a kind of maturity a couple of weeks before with Paul Kingsnorth, his series of essays called This Vaccine Moment, and then a kind of viral interview that he did. And that was the first time that I really heard the antithesis position expressed in a really considered, really intelligent and...
But now, notice, this is the first time he heard the antithesis position expressed from someone who is in the antithetical to the antithesis, someone who is outside the, or he heard the antithesis. This is where you get the sense of revelation.
Very kind of measured way.
So there are two conversations you can have. There's the one about, is the vaccine safe and should you have it? And that's a conversation that's been going on for a long time, which everybody's furious about increasingly because this whole conversation has fallen.
Now, pay attention here back to maps of meaning and the beginning fork in the road of maps of meaning where Jordan Peterson starts out his book. The world can be conceived of in two different ways. One is a space of objects and the other is a forum for action. Pay attention to how often, as we continue to leave modernity, as we continue to shift from the third personal into the first personal, how often forum for action is the frame that people are leaning into
the ruts of the culture war. And that will go on and on and on. And again, as I say, personal decision whether you do that or not. But then there's the other conversation, which is about whether your vaccine status should be used to demonstrate your acceptable position in society. Now, that is something radically new.
So Paul,
and that, of course, very quickly triggers people in terms of religion, because doesn't religion delineate people's status? And it's not just in terms of this is in some ways triggers the Enlightenment critique of religion in us. We've all been set up to say, then go back to the new atheists and, well, it's religious people that are bigoted. It's religious people who categorize other people based on aspects of their lives that they may or may not be able to take responsibility for or have a choice of. That's the kinds of thing religions do. The opposite of religion is inclusion and acceptance of all. But very quickly, it was the thesis tribe that began playing what everyone recognized to be a religious game because of the formation that the new atheist conversation had used against the church.
Paul's someone who's been on Rebel Wisdom before. He's someone I really respect. And even though I don't agree with everything that he wrote in the essays, I think it was written in a really open and curious way. And I think his argument...
There are David's values, open and curious. And that's in some ways... Again, we don't see these values very quickly. But those are the good values, open and curious. And now I'm... Anybody who watches my channel knows I love open and curious because I'm very open and very curious. But we should just recognize that these are the values. And these values will be shaped in terms of, let's say, a Big Five personality profile. You can map them onto that. You can map them onto a lot of different things.
And his perspective needs to be engaged with. I don't think he's playing a tribal game. But when I read them, I was immediately concerned that it would be seen in a really tribal way.
Now, there's an aversion to tribes, which is, of course, again, probably some more latent secularity. Because Ali was just a minute ago talking about these new religions. Those new religions are going to make tribes. Tribalism is inevitable because you're not going to have a new religion without a new community. And another word for that new community is a tribe. And so... you know, this aversion to tribalism is something we should up the resolution on and say we should not be so sensitive to tribal formation. What we should probably be thinking about is how must we navigate a world with more tribes? Because in a sense, what radio did was create some huge tribes. I often noted to people that what happened in the seeker movement towards the end of the 20th century is that churches were no longer differentiated by propositional doctrinal assertion as much as which radio stations they listened to. Because increasingly, especially in evangelical churches, the pastor is not as important in terms of church growth, church development and the ability of a church to really capture and motivate people. I mean, Paul Anleitner notes music is the sacrament of evangelical, big box evangelical Pentecostal churches. That means that the worship pastor is probably the most important person and the music is most important. And so really you're down to what radio station do you listen to? And if in fact you want to try to grow a church, now this gets super complex and we have that really wonderful conversation with Sam too about music. It's so integral that communities and tribes are being formed around other things other than, let's say, well, why were churches segregated into theological tribes? Well, the printing press, the Peace of Augsburg, the 30 Years' War, the Protestant Reformation. And in a sense, many of these old layers don't go away. They just continue on. Now, I've got 5 minutes here before our conversation, so I got to figure out where to land this plane for now.
So I asked him if he was worried that what he wrote would be weaponized.
I don't want what I'm writing to be used by particular tribes, actually. And I'm trying to make sure I write it in a way that it's hard for a particular tribe to grab it and use it. But there's always that risk. I think at the moment, that's where we are. It's very hard to do anything that doesn't get sucked in by somebody, other than just shutting up.
But if you're really successful, you'll make a new tribe. They'll be the Paul Kingsnorth tribe. All right, I'm only 8 minutes and 28 seconds into this thing. We'll see if I return to it. It all depends on my ADHD. But if you haven't listened to this, it's well worth a listen. And there's a ton of stuff in here. You know, a bunch of the John Vervaeke stuff I thought was excellent. I'll be talking to John and Sam tomorrow morning. By the time this is released, I'll actually be having the conversation at the time that this thing is released. So anyway, I've got a church meeting tonight. I've got travel to do. I've got a whole bunch of things I got to do. So sorry for the lack of content, but that's just the way it goes sometimes.